The Provoke Podcast, brought to you by Provoke Media and produced by the international broadcast specialist, Marketeers.
Welcome, everybody, to our latest Provoke Media podcast. I'm Paul Holmes, founder of Provoke Media, and I'm joined here today by two of our good friends from Zeno Group. And I'm going to ask Penny and Alison to introduce themselves, and then we're going to get started with a discussion of some very interesting research into the responsibility reset. Penny, tell us who you are.
Hello, Paul. I'm Penny Kazakos. I lead the Issues and Crisis team for Zeno Group here in the U.S.
And Alison.
Yes, Alison De Silva. I lead our Global Purpose and Impact team here at Zeno.
Great. And a little while ago, we were presented with some very interesting research from Zeno, which is going to form the basis of this discussion. Just to sort of set the scene briefly, I think, and correct me if I'm getting any of the narrative wrong here, I think that over the last 5 or 6 years, we saw an almost unprecedented rush into engagement around social and political issues by the leaders of global corporations. This was a response, I think, to a number of things, the pressure on companies to withdraw from Russia after the invasion of Ukraine, the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States and then globally, which companies, I think, felt compelled to respond to, issues around the rights of LGBTQ consumers and citizens around the world, and the sort of hunger for greater equality there, and then a host of other, I don't want to say smaller issues, but less obviously politicized issues, as investors began to demand more information on ESG and employees began to demand greater action on DEI. And for about 4 years, 5 years there around the pandemic, we saw this sort of headlong rush into let's get involved with every political issue that even blips on our radar and take a stand and be good corporate citizens. And then over the last 12 to 18 months, I think we've seen something of a backlash. There's been a lot of criticism of DEI and ESG specifically. There has been a countervailing pressure from those who would rather not see progress for either ethnically diverse populations or the LGBTQ community. Certainly, companies last year were made to pay a price for their activism around these issues. And so we've seen criticism of companies from Bud Light to Target to Starbucks to Boeing over being what I guess we're supposed to call woke these days. And so that has given a lot of companies pause. And you've done some research to examine and understand what expectations are from stakeholders and what pressures CEOs are feeling. And I think both of those are really interesting topics, particularly since they diverge slightly. But let's talk first of all about consumer attitudes around the world and what has happened in terms of the consumer expectations for companies to take an active role in solving big problems.
Paul, thank you for setting the stage so well, because you're right. Over the last 18 months, really even 2 years, all of these topics have become so politicized, so polarized, that companies are so hesitant about What do they do? What do they say for fear of backlash? And that was the fact. We know this is taking incredible amounts of time and pressure on our clients, on corporate leaders. And we've been in the trenches with them, trying to help them navigate in a way that is helping them protect their reputation, but also strengthen their reputation and still make progress on those issues where they need to still be showing up and advancing. Staying still isn't an option. So that was really the backdrop for why we wanted to do this global research and also understand the nuances across markets about what are the expectations, what are the barriers, and what does this mean for business leaders moving forward. From a consumer perspective, nearly 70% of global consumers and stakeholders still expect brands to address societal topics, and nearly as many actually want companies to do even more. And what the tension, if you will, is that two-thirds of corporate leaders actually feel like they're doing enough. So that's a gap between what consumers want and what, you know, CEOs are thinking their role is. The C-suite agrees that these issues are too important to disengage from, 84%. So that's, you know, pretty close to unanimous. You know, companies are saying, we can't just back away. We can't stand still. But they do feel, three quarters of them feel that no matter what they do, they're going to upset one stakeholder group. And that is our new normal. Penny, I know, would love to share sort of an additional insight that's been top of mind and very important to a lot of our clients as well.
Yeah, you know, when we looked at that a little deeper, there was some good news in that. What are they looking for? What are they reaching for? And what they want is confidence that moving forward and navigating in this new space is going to yield that advancement in their reputation. So how do they do that? Now, I think when you look at preparedness, you got to look at what are you doing before a crisis hits, right? There's before, during, and after a crisis. Are you doing enough in the before? And when we dug a little deeper, we discovered that only 25% of corporate leaders told us that they have a formal process in place to anticipate, measure, evaluate the sensitivities among their stakeholders when they do choose to engage. Only 25% have those frameworks, processes in place. Well, what does that mean? It means 75% do not. And that's where you can be doing the work to gain that confidence so that whether it's coming from the C-suite or whether it's coming from the board, the questions in this really divisive and toxic news environment that we're in right now, you look at the headlines and questions come in, inevitably it's like, what are we doing to make sure that that's not us next time? Mm-hmm. And that speaks to the heart of preparedness. You know, when we look at the frameworks and processes, what could that look like? It's everything from good old-fashioned stakeholder mapping, you know, understanding the hearts and minds of those who matter most to your business. It's certainly scenario planning. You know, we used to do a lot of it in compliance and risk. Understanding business continuity scenario plans was always part of the game. But I think what we've seen in the last couple of years is that companies are just as concerned about understanding the reputational risk along these societal topics. So we've added those components to the crisis scenario playbook. And then so much of what we've seen recently comes out of the creator space, the creative campaigns. And a lot of companies are asking themselves, do we have the right guidelines in place? So when they're working with creators, celebrities, you know, how do you evaluate the risk and the reward around creative campaigns? And, you know, we take clients through those kinds of frameworks and really customize them to what they want to get out of those activities. So when you look at the spectrum of preparedness, it's really about giving confidence to your leadership that you've got the tools in place.
Okay. So there's a huge amount to unpack from those two answers. So let me think about how to build on this. I think the first thing that struck me from what you were saying, Alison, both in terms of consumer expectations and how CEOs understand the issue, is as politically fraught as this has become, everybody seems to understand that we're not going back to the era where you could say the business of business is business, and everything else is a distraction, and we're not going to get distracted. We're not going to pay attention. We're just going to get on pumping out widgets or whatever it is we're pumping out and let the world go on around us. That era is dead, right?
Correct. Unequivocally, Paul, we asked the question to both consumers and the C-suite, what do you believe the role of business is? In terms of addressing and advancing these different issues, what we found was over 84% of both consumers and CEOs said, we need to go beyond compliance. This isn't about just delivering a shareholder return and checking the box that we're not breaking any rules. The large majority, 68% of consumers and 78% of C-suite, said our role is really in the middle. It's to support organizations and causes that are relevant to our business, and also to advocate for those issues that we can put the power of our business behind to help address and really advocate for proactively. And then similarly, on, you know, about 8% said your role is to be an activist. So the days where the expectation of just every company has to stand up for every issue because that's the thing to do, that's a little bit of where we are in the reset. It's like, let's go back to, you know, a common sense approach. What are these topics that are material to our business, that are relevant to our industry, that are aligned with our purpose and our mission and our values and our stakeholders? And let's see how we can be consistent and applying our business to make progress on those issues. Again, versus trying to sort of do it all and be everywhere.
Right.
I mean, you know, when I think about what you just said, Alison, about the connecting back to the business, when we, Paul, first, you know, enter a client's office and we're having these kinds of conversations, we do take it down to the basics. You know, we ask these very simple questions that start the discussion so that we can understand where their appetite is. And it always starts with the authenticity. How does your engagement on whatever topic align to your vision, your mission, and your values? That's number one. Number two is the business relevance. How does it tie back to the widget you sell, the services you sell? How does it tie back to the operations and function of your business? You've got to have some connectivity there. And then lastly, the capacity to actually make meaningful change. Are you adding to the noise? Are you adding to the spiral and piling on? Or can you actually affect meaningful change? And I think when you put it through the prism of these initial questions, you start to unpack why they want to engage, how they want to engage. And from there, you can build the parameters that allow them to do it in a safe way.
Right. And that last point is very interesting to me, because it seemed to me as this wave of activism broke over the last few years, that there was in many cases a performative element to it. Or maybe it's just the feeling that, well, we spoke out about X, so now people will expect to speak out about Y and Z and, you know, N and Q and B and D. I mean, I'm deliberately not using D and I and CSR as my initials here. But, you know, that once you've started commenting on something, it sort of snowballs. And I wonder, one of the things that I found interesting in the research was the geographic differences. Mm-hmm. So there are some issues that have tremendous salience with stakeholders in Europe that are less important to stakeholders in the US, for example. Talk about that, and then talk about how companies should deal with that? Do you end up saying one thing in one market and another somewhere else, or do you have to be globally consistent around those issues?
Well, when we did the survey, we did it across 7 markets in the consumer category. We spoke to more than 7,000 consumers in 7 countries: Canada, China, France, Germany, Singapore, the US, and the UK. For the C-suite category, we hit all the main geographic regions and spoke with over 200 C-suite leaders from large companies. And we did that in partnership with the Financial Times Commercial Insights Group. And when we looked at all that across the 20 societal issues we asked them to consider, is everything from poverty, gun control, LGBTQ, mental health, all of that. Really surprising was that most of the countries outside of the US and Canada felt that climate change was a top issue. It was in the top three, if not the top five, in every other geography except the US and Canada. So, when you're looking at that, first of all, it tells you that it's not a one size fits all. When you're navigating which issues to participate in and which to not, and you're sitting in a multinational company, if you think one approach is going to work, it's not. There are different priorities in each market according to your stakeholders, your consumers, and really honing in on what matters to them is going to get you a much better result.
Just one build on that. Your question, Paul, about global versus local approach. When you use the guardrails of relevance to your business and industry, and you connect it to business strategy, there are some issues, of course, and topics that need to be set at the global level and consistent. If you're a food and beverage company and you're not talking about climate change and packaging, and you need soil to produce the food that you're buying. If you're a hospitality company and you're not looking at sustainable tourism, people won't be visiting the areas where you may have properties. So if you go back to the why you're supporting issues, it can't just be gun control was number five in the US, so therefore we should support gun control. Go back to what makes sense for the business, the industry, the topics. And then you can certainly double click and activate and customize your approach in each market based on the feedback from the survey and cultural and social nuances.
That's really interesting to me because it implies, I think, that companies need to do a better job of maybe drawing a line between the issues and the stands that they're taking and the business strategy, right? So, this is a topic that we've talked a lot about in the US. I think that DEI was sort of presented by a lot of companies as an almost altruistic response to the Black Lives Matter movement. Oh, we need to help this segment of the population more. And that makes us good corporate citizens. When the reality, I would like to think, is that DEI is a strategic business imperative, that it's about broadening the talent pool that you recruit from. It's about having a company that looks more like the stakeholders that depend on your organization, upon whom your organization depends, and that it's about better decision making by having traditionally excluded viewpoints as part of the decision making process. And companies, I think, in both DEI and ESG have failed to explain that these are not, political decisions that they're making, but strategic business decisions. And we need to be just much more explicit about why we're getting involved in these issues to begin with, to sort of head off some of the controversy.
Absolutely, Paul. I mean, the terms ESG and DE&I have become so polarizing. What they represent are business strategies that should be intrinsically linked throughout the organization and operations as a way to Not just mitigate risk, but gain competitive advantage, meet the needs of your different stakeholders internally, to your point about DE&I, how that's so critical. And what we're doing with clients, there still is a benefit to society. And that is the expectation that's coming through, you know, in our research. Consumers do expect you to not just care about shareholder return and adhering to the law. They do expect you to play a positive role in the world. That being said, how we need to evolve the narrative and how we're counseling clients is to keep asking the question of, why are you doing this? How is this connected to your business? How is this driving, again, performance, resiliency, advantage, creativity? And then, yes, and it's also creating a more equitable future. Yes, it's also preserving our natural resources. So it's just about like hierarchy of messages. And I do believe that evolving that narrative will dissuade, hopefully begin to dissuade or chip away from those who are, you know, really carrying this, you know, this anti-woke flag, if you will, around these topics. It's just good business.
Right. So strategic relevance is one factor in the decision-making process. What about values? And to what extent should companies be making these decisions based on core values? And to what extent does the concept of core values even mean anything or resonate with stakeholders outside of the company?
Your values are your guardrails for how you make decisions and how you act as it relates to these types of topics. It's whether it's ethics or whatever the case may be, they are meant to serve as key factors in deciding what to do or what to say. They're very, very important. And you can see those companies that have taken missteps. It's because they're not connecting it back to their purpose, to their values, to those guardrails that should be informing how they are acting and how they are responding. So, they're critical. And I feel that oftentimes a lot of companies don't have values that are prescriptive enough to really serve as their guide. And so for every company, they should say, do scenario planning based on that. If this were a situation to happen, let's look at, are our values prescriptive enough to show us the path forward? And a lot of companies are going through that exercise right now.
What about individual companies and their appetite for risk or controversy here? Obviously, you know, there are some companies that are quite comfortable making big, highly visible stands on critical issues, and others who would rather play mediators, which I guess is part of your continuum from compliance to activism, right? There are some companies that seem to be natural activists, and to have built that into their proposition and their brand. But for the majority of companies, what does that middle ground look like, and how do they decide where on the continuum they should be?
Well, we do a lot of work to discover that. So when you look at that middle ground, it's at, you know, 68% of consumers telling us they want companies in that middle ground. And the support category is about aligning yourself, your purpose, and what you want to accomplish with partners who have subject matter expertise in that societal topic. So
just to be clear, support isn't just putting out a statement that says, we support you, and then moving on, right? Yeah. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, we defined support for the purposes of the survey as acting in partnership with organizations that have subject matter expertise beyond your own.
Right.
Okay. So allyship. And then advocacy is offering your business resources to a cause, whether financial or other resources, and doing it together. Now, bringing those two together at 68%, that offers companies a really good starting point on how to define what they want to be, how they want to show up. And from there, you build your plans with actual specific activations and, you know, choose your allies accordingly and choose, you know, where you want to put your resources. But that's a really good starting ground.
Right. And Paul, just one build. We do have a tool. It's a response protocol that we use that has a series of questions that go much deeper than what we've shared with you today. But, you know, asking, facilitating discussions with the senior leaders and getting alignment on things like, you know, looking at different issues, putting them through the filter of some of the questions we've asked, but also, what is your risk tolerance? Would you be willing to stay with this issue in the long term, even if there's backlash? And what is the direct impact of engaging on this issue to your business, your bottom line, your share price, your employee morale? You know, are there any government implications or relationships that could be damaged? How does this issue, does it directly impact the well-being of your different stakeholder groups, from your employees to your consumers? So there's frameworks in place that I know a lot of companies have. We use one, but there's others out there. And it does give you the security of saying, okay, well, this is where we are in the risks spectrum. For example, our employees are a priority. If this is a topic like, you know, rescinding Roe v. Wade or things like that, that is top of mind for our employees, we're going to want to engage with them on that level. So there's different levers to turn to know where on that spectrum you sit. And it's going to vary based on the issues as well.
Yeah. And I think one thing we're seeing right now in high demand is not just putting it on paper, but stress testing it with simulations. So, you know, imagine companies that, you know, they've defined what they want to be and how they want to show up. And it's a great plan, but then stress testing it. How do we build that muscle memory in the organization to withstand the blind spots, the pressure points? And we take the leadership and oftentimes layers below the leadership through a simulation and uncover considerations, things they need to mitigate. And it really strengthens their approach and more clearly defines where their appetite is. So there are various layers we can add to, you know, the preparedness efforts here that give the C-suite, the board, confidence that you're proceeding in a way that's not going to damage the brand or reputation in any way.
Right. I wanted to come back, Penny, to something that you said right at the beginning of the conversation, which was that only 25% of the CEOs that responded had any kind of formal process involved for deciding whether to jump into an issue. And, you know, certainly until recently, a lot of these decisions, it seems to me, were, I mean, I've been doing this a long time, right? It used to be that companies chose their causes because the CEO's wife was passionate about them.
Yeah.
And then it went to sort of, well, this has some tangential relationship to our business and maybe we can, you know, get some good CSR coverage out of it. But do you think CEOs understand that there is now, in fact, a data-driven approach to this, that you can use data tools to map out what the likely response is likely to be and to be a little predictive about how much backlash they can anticipate and indeed how much credit they can get? Do you think we've done enough to sort of tell them about those tools?
I think we can do more, but yes, when I think what we're seeing now is when they embark on this journey to understand their appetite for risk and how they want to navigate through these waters, when you bring it to life with data, they see where the benefits are and we know which direction is optimal for them. You know, we go through these exercises and then we take the issues that they care about. And we'll map the narratives that cluster around those issues. And we have AI tools that help us with that. And when you look at that narrative dashboard and you track it over time, and you see who the players are, and you align those players with your stakeholder priorities, you start to see the dots connect on where your allies are and where your detractors are. And it helps you make really strategic decisions. And I think when you put some science behind the art of PR in that way, it really does cement for leaders that there is a way to do this. You know, that again, it comes back to the confidence of preparedness. There is a way to do this in a way that doesn't damage. And I think that is what they're hungry for. And when you look at the questions that come our way from the comms team, it's really about helping me reassure leadership that this path forward is going to be the right decision. So what can we do to illuminate that vision and put, again, the science behind the art of PR to give them confidence is, I think, 80% of what we're here to accomplish with a client and where we find ourselves in this moment.
And I think that, I mean, I think that's an exceptionally useful insight, because my guess is that the majority of CEOs got to the C-suite without ever having to spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, what's my position on LGBTQ rights and who's going to attack me if I speak out about DEI or climate change. That's not their natural skill set. Expecting them to be able to make gut decisions is perhaps unreasonable, but providing them with data and being able to sort of take them through the likely consequences has to give them a comfort level that they wouldn't otherwise have, and helping them understand that this is not, you know, sort of a complete mystery, that there are people who have studied this and have spent years researching it and thinking through the conversations that we have, has to be really useful. And we have so much more data now than we did 20 years ago because of social media and other tools.
Yeah, if you're not leveraging your analytics and kind of the science that we can now put to these exercises, if you're not leveraging that, I don't think you can adequately give visibility to what's possible and where your blind spots are, where your, you know, where your watch outs are. And I think that's as much of the discussion as anything else. When we start a conversation with a client about all this, it's not a rosy picture all the time. But how do we get to the best possible outcome is what this journey is all about. You know, you could take it even further from the data and the science behind it. We could do live dashboards. I mean, the science is just incredible now. You can, as a communicator, wake up every day, fire up your desktop and see all your monitoring, all your kind of the stakeholder universe and how that ties back to your messages, who's saying what about the topics you care about. It really rises up and you can tie it into your customer service data, you know, the calls into your customer care line. All of that is data that can be visible on a dashboard. So you can connect the dots across operations, reputation, you know, my partnerships and allies and advocates in the industry. Who's talking about what? It's a really dynamic environment. And clients that want to take it to that level can have a significant amount of visibility into the conversations that touch their business every day.
And as Penny said, the data and the analytics, that gives the assurance to, you know, the clients that, okay, this isn't just your personal opinion. It's grounded in data. However, there's the human side as well. And I think that's what has also changed. So the days in the past, there's a crisis, there's an issue, you go to your head of crisis. Today, when we're counseling clients, it's Penny, it's me, it's our head of DE&I, it's our head of analytics, it's someone from our influencer team. And you have 5 hours. You have to be agile. You have to take that issue. You have to take the data and then you have to interpret it in a way and ask those other softer questions, those strategic guardrails, you have to apply that like subject matter expertise that you might be bringing to really get to the best outcome. So it is definitely a new world in terms of breaking down those silos between functions within a company, within agencies, to take that multidisciplinary perspective.
You know, and we oftentimes have to break the client silos for them. You know, it's hard to get the result you want sometimes. You got to figure out the company culture that you're working with. And sometimes in these quick moments, you're working within the news environment you're in, there needs to be that collaborative effort. And we've been really lucky in that.
Yeah.
Right. And sorry, just to be really specific, you talked earlier to me about your narrative intelligence product process and how that informs this. Just tell me a little bit about what that looks like.
So the narrative intelligence is one of our many tools. And it comes from, it's led by our analytics team. And essentially it looks at the conversation around brand, around the topics a company cares about, around the alliances and partnerships they want to build. It looks at the entirety of the conversation and it pulls the clusters of what's gravitating and it shows you the different conversations and how they connect. And the layers you can add on that and go deeper are incredible. Like if you have your stakeholder mapping done and you've identified your allies in the universe, you can see who's gravitating to what conversation. And what you do with that can really guide your strategic plan. You know, do you pick this advocate over that partner? Do you align yourself with an industry organization and in what way? So it can help you make some really strategic decisions in this space. And we find it best utilized when you track over time so that you can see how the conversations change. Some of the, what we track is, you know, it's within the news cycle and it's gone. Other narratives are more long lasting and they linger and there is sustainability there when you want to engage. And oftentimes those are the ones you want to put real muscle power behind. So again, it's all a matter of getting that visibility into the narrative so that you can understand where you want to play and how you want to show up.
And it's, and when you're talking about allies and advocates, it's on both sides of the aisle. So it's, you know, we can identify, for example, oh, this one organization who's really been behind a lot of explosive, you know, backlash is gravitating to this issue. They're starting to spread and get engaged on this. Okay, well, we have a sense then that that will continue to elevate. Or this environmental NGO is, you know, really going strong on X, Y, and Z. So, okay, now we, so it gives us a little bit of a predictive of knowing, okay, once these different voices are getting engaged, we can see the ripple effect of how it's going to pick up momentum and steam and what the implications might be for clients.
Yeah, and in the other direction, Paul, we can see what's viral and conversations you don't want to be involved in. So we've done the work to identify who are the divisive voices on the edges, right? in the extremes. And when they join the conversation and how they engage, we can see that. And we can decide where and how we show up in that moment. And that is an incredibly powerful tool.
And it seemed to me, looking at the research, that the one needle that we really need to move is on that understanding that this can be approached with a real discipline and with a real process. You kept using the word guardrails. And I mean, I think that's incredibly appropriate because we have seen people go way off track and crash and burn. Because they didn't understand what they were plunging into. It seems to me that we are at a point now as an industry, and certainly Zeno has played a great part in this, of being able to show people, you know, what the road ahead looks like and how they can avoid crashing off a cliff or running headlong into a speeding truck or whatever my metaphor is going to get very tortured in a minute. But that there are ways to light the path ahead and to drive safely through all of these issues. And that's a much better option than just throwing up your hands and saying, ah, oh, this is terrifying, let's back away.
I think you hit it squarely on the head.
Yeah, and it's not just about crisis and issue management. It's also about helping our clients advance progress and build reputation around those issues that they want to and should be supporting in a way that also protects their reputation. Because if you go in eyes wide open and you know what might be coming, you can navigate that quickly before the ripple effect. So it's really this nice balance of both proactive and preparedness.
Let's bring it back to that point, because I think that's really critical and really interesting. Is, we started out, I think, 5 years ago with this attitude of, wow, this is an area where we can get lots of credit for doing good things. Let's do everything. And then we got to a point where it's like, oh my God, everybody's attacking us for doing this. Let's not do anything. And balancing that risk and reward, we spent a lot of this conversation talking about the risk and how to mitigate it. But let's remember at the end of this conversation that there is, in fact, a reward, that people want you to engage judiciously with these issues. They want you to make a difference in the world. They want you to show that you care about more than just maximizing quarterly returns for shareholders. They want you to show that you care about stakeholders, about employees, about customers, about communities, and about the planet. And so having an offering like this that can help you gain the benefits while minimizing the risks is absolutely optimal.
Absolutely. You heard me saying, we say this a lot within the walls of Zeno. You can't just stay still. You can't be paralyzed in fear. You can't just retreat, because we also, and you know this, we're seeing the backlash again around DE&I hushing, sustainability, green hushing. If you're not talking about what you're doing, if it's important to the business and relevant to the business and something that's integrated, you shouldn't stay quiet for fear of backlash. That's still something that can build your reputation, that can inspire your employees, that can provide that competitive advantage. When you're buying your goods on shelf, you're saying, oh wow, this company cares. This is made with, sustainable materials. So it's just about doing it in a way where you feel, going back to what Penny said, confident that the things you're choosing to talk about, you're doing for the right reasons, and you're willing to stand behind those decisions and that communications, and you're able to weather any voice or backlash that comes your way. Because the world we're living in, unfortunately, as we said, someone's always going to say something, especially behind the safety of their social media profile.
You can be responsible and resilient at the same time.
Exactly.
That's great. Thank you very much, both of you. That was a lovely, lively discussion. I would happily point anyone towards your research, the responsibility research. I just think it's a really useful insight into where we are right now and where we need to take the conversation in the next few years. And very much appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts on this with us and with our audience today. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Yes, appreciate your time.
You've been listening to the Provoke Podcast, brought to you by Provoke Media and produced by the international broadcast specialist, Marketeers.